Welcome to the 15th Annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. I am Eugene Meyer, President of the Federalist Society, and this memorial lecture started, as many of you know, shortly after 9/11. Ted Olson's inaugural lecture reminded us of what it means to be an American and how our legal system is a critical part of our identity as Americans. Perhaps we could stand to be reminded of that again today. Both Ted and Barbara, and Ted unfortunately can't be here today, he was scheduled to be here, and the weather messed up his transportation, and he's out of town and remaining out of town, unfortunately. But both Ted and Barbara understood this connection. We want the lecture series to remind lawyers of it, so they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. Our other lecturers have included a distinguished cast: Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Vice President Cheney, Judges Ken Starr, Robert Bork, Ray Randolph, Edith Jones, Doug Ginsburg, Dennis Jacobs, and then Judge, now Justice, Neil Gorsuch, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, former White House Counsel Don McGahn, and Peter Thiel, John Allison, and Senators Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse. This brings us to today's lecture. It's my honor to introduce for this year's Barbara Olson Lecture the Honorable Jeff Sutton, who was a judge for the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Prior to this, he was a partner with the law firm of Jones Day, Rivas & Pogue in Columbus since 1996. And before that, he was an associate with the firm where he specialized in commercial litigation, constitutional litigation, and appellate practice. Since 1993, Judge Sutton has been an adjunct professor of law at Ohio State, at the Ohio State University College of Law, as all of our football fans understand, teaching seminars on the United States Constitution and state constitutional law. Since 2012, Judge Sutton has taught a class on state constitutional law at Harvard Law School. From 95 to 98, he was the state solicitor for the state of Ohio. I would add, at a time when there weren't quite as many state solicitors, but he oversaw all the appellate litigation on behalf of the Attorney General and participated in complex litigation on her behalf at the trial level. Judge Sutton had clerked before for Justice Lewis Powell and Justice Scalia. He's argued 12 cases in the United States Supreme Court, received his BA from Williams College and his JD from the Ohio State University College of Law. He teaches a class at Harvard Law School, I mentioned that already, but on state constitutional law, and has co-authored a casebook, and more recently, and more importantly for us and for this lecture, he recently wrote 51 Imperfect Solutions, which I suspect he will talk about a bit. It is a real honor to have Judge Sutton to deliver the 2018 Barbara Olson Lecture. Judge.
Wow, thank you, Gene. When you write a book, you learn who your friends are. I'm deeply honored to give this year's Barbara Olson Lecture. I knew Barbara and I know Ted, and I'm proud to call them both friends. Barbara believed in the power of ideas and spent her all too brief time on this earth promoting them. Count me as a fellow traveler. The theme of this year's convention is good government through agency accountability and regulatory transparency. Let me start with some judicial transparency. If anyone thought that I would have the good taste to refrain from talking about state constitutions or promoting the ideas in 51 Imperfect Solutions, I have some bad news. I do not have that kind of restraint. The phrase assumption of the risk comes to mind. The good news is that my topic, federalism, is no stranger to the theme of the conference, separation of powers. There is one other reason I cannot resist talking about the book. Many of the ideas in it grew out of a national convention 21 years ago. In 1997, the Society put together a panel on City of Bernie and the Future of Federalism. As is the Society's custom, its most radical and impressive custom, the panel had intellectual diversity. In a minor breach of separation of powers, I moderated the discussion and participated as a panelist in it. On my side of the debate was someone I did not know, Bill Pryor, then the Attorney General of Alabama. The two of us were picked to carry the state side of the debate on the theory that we would agree with each other, because he was the Alabama AG and I was the Ohio SG. That's not how it worked out. As I neared the end of my presentation, I made a passing comment about the reality that state courts can do all kinds of innovative things under the banner of federalism, including invalidating state school systems, state funding systems under their own constitutions. Bill did not like that idea one bit. He had suffered through the defense of one such lawsuit in Alabama, and he proceeded to grill me about the utter failings of these lawsuits. Who is this guy, I thought. We were supposed to be on the same side of the debate. I'd given him a wonderful introduction. No matter, he let me have it. Not one to dodge an argument, I defended my point and the virtues, even if unpredictable virtues, of federalism. Back and forth we went, each completely convinced the other was wrong, the other two panelists just watching us. I probably called him a fair-weather federalist, and he probably called me a judicial activist. Fighting words. Learned Hand once said that the spirit of liberty is the spirit which is not too sure that it is right. Bill and I did not win any Learned Hand awards that day. But we did win each other's friendship and respect, a quintessential Federalist Society story. One of us a son of the North, one of us a son of the South, one a Protestant, one a Catholic, and most improbably of all, one of us an Ohio State fan, and one an annoying Alabama fan. Easily the best line in the talk. What mattered was a shared interest in getting the big questions right, even if it meant arguing about them from time to time. Bill still second guesses me now and then. Just this past week, as if on cue, he sent me an email questioning one of my decisions. What are friends for? Bill and I ended up doing a lot of work together. He hired me to handle 3 merits cases in the US Supreme Court and to write several amicus briefs there. Greg Katsas also worked with us in many of those cases. Not a bad team. Together, our work at the US Supreme Court, I would like to think, increased the profile of state AG and state SG offices. Before long, Bill created an SG position for Alabama, the second occupant of which was Kevin Newsom. The Ohio office continues to have a good reputation, and Texas played a leadership role as well. In the 1990s, the late and much beloved Gray Coleman got the Texas SG position off the ground, and it too has flourished with help from the likes of Ted Cruz, Jim Ho, Kyle Duncan, and Andy Oldham, among others. Just recently, New Hampshire became the 40th state to create a state SG position. All of this has been good for American law, and the Federalist Society had a lot to do with it. By insisting on intellectual diversity in its programs, the Society incubates good ideas and makes good ideas better. And by devoting so much programming to separation of powers, it's really, frankly, quite exhausting, the Society never lets us lose sight of the most essential but most neglected question in American constitutional law: who decides? So enough about me and the Federalist Society. Let's talk about me and my book. It's really quite outrageous. It'll be over soon. My position is that we have lost track of how to identify and develop judicially enforceable rights, and in the process, lost track of our constitutional roots. Let me offer a few reasons why we need to take state constitutions and the courts that interpret them more seriously. One is historical. The individual rights we prize the most, free exercise, free speech, due process, right to counsel, all originated in the state constitutions. The greatest era of constitution writing in this country, indeed in world history, was between 1776 and before the fabled summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. Whether it's the individual rights provisions in the original U.S. Constitution or the Bill of Rights, they were authored by the framers of the state constitutions, not the other way around. The foundational idea was that the state courts would be the first responders in addressing new infringements on liberty, and the state constitutions would be the principal shields in saving individuals from new threats to their freedom. In truth, the 1787 Philadelphia Convention involved more cutting and pasting than original drafting. The only truly patentable idea that came out of the convention was, in Justice Kennedy's words, splitting the atom of sovereignty, a division of vertical power that gave birth to American federalism and that gave birth to dual roles for state and federal courts in protecting constitutional liberties. A second point is this. Anyone who cares about judicially enforceable rights should prefer two shots rather than just one to invalidate a state or local law or to protect against a state or local criminal prosecution. There are 51 constitutions in this country and 51 high courts to interpret them. The key individual rights protections appear in virtually every state constitution as well as the federal constitution. Only a lawyer half interested in obtaining relief for his client would pay attention to just one of those shots. And only a law school that wanted its graduates to be half equipped to solve their clients' problems would neglect teaching the second shot, the state shot. Given the frequency with which lawyers put all of their efforts in just one place, the U.S. Constitution, it's fair to revisit that age-old existential question: are American basketball players smarter than American lawyers? The answer is easy, and it's an indictment of our shared profession. No American basketball player ever took just one shot after a two-shot foul. My third point is that a renewed interest in state constitutions would be healthy for federal constitutional law and for the U.S. Supreme Court. Year by year, the U.S. Supreme Court exercises more control over our lives. If we federal judges share some of the blame for this development, it's worth remembering that we Americans need to look in the mirror as well. Our country adores judicially enforceable rights, and I doubt any country in world history has embraced them with more gusto than we have. For what it is worth, I'm a skeptic of our modern obsession with judicially enforceable rights. They are overrated in at least two ways. They overrun the compromises often needed to make democracy work, and they rarely settle disputes in a way that creates lasting tolerance of minority perspectives. Let me make the point this way. If I had to pick between the 1964 Civil Rights Act or Brown versus Board of Education, and I could only have one, I would always take the 64 Civil Rights Act. What would you rather have? A country in which 5 to 9 members of a life-tenured court protect our rights, or a country in which we create a legal and social norm in which the majority looks after the interests of the minority? While I may be an optimist, I am not delusional. A legal culture that embraces judicially enforceable rights is not going away anytime soon. So I must deal with the world as it is, not as I wish it could be. In our current world, the incentives to seek winner-take-all victories in Washington, D.C. remain high and will stay high. Who doesn't want to sideline a policy opponent with a constitutional victory at the U.S. Supreme Court? There is just one small problem with this situation. Unless you've been hiding under a rock for the last few decades, you may have noticed that it is getting harder to fill these seats on the U.S. Supreme Court, indeed on all of the federal courts. The intensity of the resulting confirmation fights runs the risk of politicizing the U.S. Supreme Court to a degree and a level that cannot be undone. I have no grand solutions here, but I have a strong conviction that increased reliance on state constitutions and state courts will improve matters. Most Americans would embrace this essential insight of federalism. In dealing with new policy challenges, it can be helpful to use the 50 states as laboratories of policymaking experimentation. Why try a novel social experiment on 325 million people and 51 jurisdictions at once? The Brandeis metaphor, of course, refers to state legislatures as these laboratories. All I am saying is that we should apply the same insight in developing constitutional rights. We should start thinking more often of the state high courts as laboratories for constitutional experimentation. So that is my opening argument. I've reserved most of my time for rebuttal. I have a sense for my audience, having given so many talks to FedSoc student and lawyer chapters around the country about the topic for the last year. Bismarck, North Dakota, for what it's worth, in the summer, was my favorite destination. I wasn't expecting it to be that much bigger in applause. But my talk to the Birmingham chapter was the most unusual and had to be a first in FedSoc history. Halfway to Birmingham, I ran into plane delays and soon realized I would not be able to get to the city in time for a noon event. Rather than cancel the event, my preference, the chapter insisted that I give the speech with my iPhone in one of the remote carrels in the Admiral's Club in the Charlotte, North Carolina airport. Somehow the folks in Birmingham found a way to put a cell phone up next to a microphone to project my talk. It worked, or so I have been told. Best I could tell from my carrel in Charlotte, everyone had left. But I do know this, two poor souls in the carrel next to me listened to the whole speech. Afterwards, I'm very proud of this, they said they liked it. So membership in the Federalist Society grew by two that day. As I can attest, and as my presence here today confirms, the Federalist Society brings together a lot of perspectives about constitutional law and about the role of the courts in enforcing it. That big tent is well represented by the range and talent of prior Barbara Olson lecturers, a wonderful testament to Barbara. So let me work through what might be the reactions of these past lecturers to what I am saying and the questions they assuredly would have for me. What would originalists like Justice Scalia, for example, say about this? Or libertarians like John Allison, or restraintists like Judge Bork? You get the idea. Let me start with Justice Scalia, always a good place to start, and always a voice whispering in my ear. So would reinvigorated state constitutionalism be good for originalism? You bet. It not only would be good for originalism, it is indispensable to it. How can anyone call himself an originalist and not take state constitutions seriously? They are the source of our federal rights and the source code for interpreting them. Just read Justice Scalia's second opinion in Heller if you doubt me. One of the key explanations for the decision was the state court interpretations of the state right to bear arms guarantees and the state court's nearly uniform interpretations that they were individual rights, not militia limited rights. All of this might explain why Justice Scalia, in his last majority opinion for the court, Kansas versus Carr, embraced what I am saying. In his words, I am quoting, "The state courts may experiment all they want with their own constitutions, and often do in the wake of this court's decisions." As support for that claim, he cited an article making the very points I am making today. I don't want to lie, it was my article. I know, there's something about that doesn't seem right. I really did not want to tell you, but then I felt my conscience kicked in. Let's move on. Past speakers like John Allison and Peter Thiel might ask whether libertarians would benefit from vigorous state constitutionalism. That too is easy. For the libertarian, state constitutionalism is the ship you have long waited for the prevailing winds to bring in. Two shots are always better than one. Most libertarians, indeed, would probably prefer three or even four ways to limit government. For now, however, don't get greedy. It's always better to have two shots rather than just one to halt enforcement of an overreaching state or local law. The point turns on math, not law. Let me illustrate the point with the Patel opinion by Don Willett, then a justice on the Texas Supreme Court, now a judge on the Fifth Circuit. At issue in Patel was a set of burdensome licensing requirements that Texas imposed on wannabe commercial hair threaders. The plaintiffs filed the challenge under the Texas Constitution's due course of law provision, presumably on the theory that they wouldn't have gotten anywhere under the U.S. Constitution. in a history-filled concurrence that all libertarians and all natural law advocates should relish, Judge Ouellette examined the Texas Constitution's protection of property and due process rights and their under-protection in the past. His thoughtful reasoning, with the memorable line, "Don't thread on me," those opportunities don't come very often in a judicial career. His opinion laid out a roadmap for other state courts to follow in honoring their own state liberty and property protections. The wee Ouellettes must have been proud of their father that day. Good, yeah, no, I could use the pause. What about the risk that if we place more emphasis on state constitutions, we will dilute respect for federal constitutional rights or diminish the role of the federal courts in protecting them? Perhaps Chief Justice Roberts and other federal judges might ask that question. The short answer is that this is the nature of federalism. We do not think any less of Congress when a state legislature takes a different path from the national legislature under its own lawmaking prerogative. It's the same thing when a state court charts a different path under its constitution. Madison was right in Federalist 51, surely, by the way, the most aptly numbered of the Federalist Papers. It's pretty good. That was a promotional point. I wasn't sure you were getting it. That's why I had to mention it. In Madison's words, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. That dictum not only means that state power sometimes limits federal power, but it also means that state courts are free to disagree with the U.S. Supreme Court decisions when exercising their sovereign duty to construe their state constitutions independently. The greatest problem in the judiciary is not when judges show, in Madison's words, that they are not angels. It's much worse when judges come to think of themselves as angels and act on that impulse in overreaching and underreaching ways. That is the story of Dred Scott, and that is the story of Buck versus Bell. The eugenics chapter in American history illustrates this peril and shows one way to avoid it. Most everyone knows about the U.S. Supreme Court's ignominious rejection of Kerry Buck's 14th Amendment claim and the jarring words that Justice Holmes used to justify it. Three generations of imbeciles is enough. What few people know is that the state courts before 1927, by and large, got the issue right. In five of the six state court decisions before Buck versus Bell, the state courts granted relief, sometimes under the federal constitution, often under their own constitutions. After 1927, however, a dozen or so more states enacted eugenics laws, and yet the state court activity and the state innovation stopped. A constitutional tradition in which we assume that federal judges are beyond reproach is not worth preserving. If Jim Crow is exhibit A, that the state courts and state constitutions sometimes fall down on the job, the eugenics movement is exhibit A, that the federal courts and federal constitutions sometimes fall down on the job. We should remember both stories, not just one. Reinvigorated state constitutionalism not only may fill liberty gaps left by misbegotten U.S. Supreme Court decisions, it also may relieve pressure on the U.S. Supreme Court to be treated as the only rights protector in the country. That has not been good for the court, or for that matter, fair to it. Anyone worried about the growth in the U.S. Supreme Court's role in American government, as I am, should embrace a partnership with the state high courts in rights interpretation. It might allow for more regional differences of opinion and perhaps more tolerance of them, or it might supply useful information for the court before it decides whether to nationalize a right. One last point on this score. It is remarkable how little we know about or appreciate the day-to-day role of the state courts in preserving the rule of law. In the last year for which we have numbers, 84 million cases were filed in the state courts, 360,000 in the federal courts. If we care about justice and freedom in this country, we should be paying far more attention to the role of state courts in establishing it. Let me echo this keen insight from the historian Leonard Levy. A society reveals itself in its law, and nowhere better than in the reports of the decisions of the state courts. The reports are, however, the wasteland of American legal history. The work of state judges is undeservedly unstudied. So long as that condition exists, there can be no history of American law, and without it, no adequate history of this nation's civilization. He made that observation in 1957. Matters have only gotten worse. Next, I can imagine Justice Gorsuch and Judge Ginsburg wondering what a renewed interest in state constitutions would do for those who care about administrative law. Here, too, is another useful story. As it turns out, many state courts have taken these state separation of powers issues quite seriously, often more so than the federal courts. Many state courts, almost half of them, have not hesitated to enforce the non-delegation doctrine with respect to state laws. One objection to enforcing the non-delegation doctrine at the federal level has been the concern that the line drawing is too difficult, a risk that the state experiences either can confirm or expose as mistaken. What of Chevron-type theories of deference at the state level? The states are all over the map, but a growing number of state courts have rejected deference to administrative agencies, often as incompatible with state separation of powers. Two of those state court decisions came in the last 8 months, one from the Mississippi Supreme Court and one from the Wisconsin Supreme Court in a thoughtful decision by Justice Dan Kelly. Each of the decisions refused to follow the federal Chevron model, and each of them invoked Justice Gorsuch's, I guess I'll call it landmark, 10th Circuit opinion in Gutierrez. It's really sad to be a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court and your landmark decisions are on the Court of Appeals, but he has time to correct that. So dialogue between the state and federal courts, as these cases show, runs in both directions. Next, I can imagine my federal court predecessors at this lectern, Judges Jacobs, Jones, Mukasey, Randolph, and Starr, and last year's speaker, Don McGahn, all wondering about the selection process for state court judges and the reality that 90% of them are elected. Well, let me just clear some brush. They don't have lists at the state court level. They've chosen some other approaches, but there's time. But the harder point is, how can one trust majoritarian elected judges, they might say, to perform a counter-majoritarian job? Well, I have a lot of firsthand experience in this area, and I can tell you not to worry. As State Solicitor of Ohio, I defended many state laws in front of the justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, who are elected to six-year terms. As I tell my students at Ohio State and Harvard, I could teach a semester-long course on state constitutional law based exclusively on cases I lost at the Ohio Supreme Court under the Ohio Constitution. These were not inconsequential cases: school funding, vouchers, tort reform, criminal procedure. Elected judges, I found out, are just as apt to be allies as foes when it comes to constitutional cases. Judicial elections, moreover, have not gotten in the way of many excellent lawyers joining the state bench. Indeed, many of them are now former state court judges because the current administration has appointed so many of them to the federal court. Good for them, I say. Go where the talent is. In the long term, that development is going to lead to more first-rate lawyers serving on state courts, and perhaps especially lead more former state SGs and deputy state SGs to serve on state courts. I cautiously predict that we are entering a golden age of state court judges. Buried in the judicial selection question, by the way, is an assumption, an elitist assumption, I fear, that state court judges are not up to snuff with federal judges. It may be true that more federal judges went to Ivy League law schools and more state court judges went to state law schools like my alma mater, the Ohio State University. Come to think of it, that may be why I like state court judges and state constitutions so much. Well, a distraction. But if it's fair to compare credentials, it's equally fair to compare performance. Ask yourself which set of judges, our state judges or our federal judges, have been more faithful to the language of their respected constitutions over time. I don't know the answer, but I have my suspicions. I suspect that the state reporters convey a greater respect for the language and original public meaning of their constitutions than the U.S. reports do for the U.S. Constitution. Keep in mind the possibility that electoral accountability and perhaps attendance at state law schools, God forbid, may make judges better, or at least better when it comes to respecting text and fixed meaning. Imagine if a judge from another country wanted to learn how we interpret statutes and constitutions. And imagine if all we gave him were the transcripts of federal court confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee to answer that question. Based on these transcripts, our visitor would assume that the overwhelming norm for American federal judges is textualism and originalism, that it's their job to interpret the law, not make it. I'm not going to ask that visitor from another country to look at the US reports. You might draw a different conclusion. Now, what about what judges say when they're running for office in state elected offices? Same thing. If you listen to those campaign speeches, you're going to see they adopt the language of originalism and textualism because that has become the acceptable norm in American political discourse when describing the appropriate role of judges, whether state or federal. In the words of Chief Justice Roberts, judges are to be the servants of the law, not the other way around. All of this gives me hope about how state judges would use the power I want them to exercise, and hope about what state citizens would do in judicial elections if judges overreached. Next, what of the perspective of those who care about judicial restraint, a view captured by one of the first Olson lecturers, Judge Robert Bork? Isn't there a risk that with a renewed interest in state constitutions, we will unleash a wave of judicial activism? Before taking on that question, let me say a word about Judge Bork. Most people in this room over age 50 have had some personal experience with him. Mine was personal, but not face to face. My first year of law school was 1987, the year he was nominated to the court. In my third year of law school, my father-in-law gave me The Tempting of America as a Christmas gift. The book changed my view of law and interpretation. When I had the good fortune of picking an active justice to work with during my year with Justice Powell, I chose Justice Scalia, a decision heavily influenced by what I had learned from Judge Bork and a decision that changed my life. I owe Judge Bork a great debt. We all do. So let's think seriously about what Judge Bork would say about my argument. He likely would point out that the last federal appellate judge to take up the cause of state constitutionalism was Justice Brennan. And he would add that history has not treated Justice Brennan as one of the great apostles of judicial restraint. Judge Bork has a point, and I can already hear another mentor of mine, Frank Easterbrook, wondering about it. Justice Brennan, it is true, wrote a landmark article in 1977 that promoted many of the themes I am promoting today. I have two responses, one that defends the Brennan piece and one that qualifies it. The first is that federalism is a two-way street. No one would take the position that it is a bad idea to have judicially enforceable limits on congressional power because some states might misuse that power. If the people of a state want judicial activists or restraintists or institutionalists, they are free to have them. And if they have buyer's remorse, they can do something about it. They can amend their state constitutions, which usually require just a 51% vote, or they can replace the judges, most of whom face electoral accountability or age limits. Those options do not exist with the US Constitution or the composition of the US Supreme Court. To offer a friendly amendment to Chief Justice Marshall's too frequently invoked comment about the US Constitution, we must never forget that we have life tenure and that it is a constitution, an essentially unamendable constitution we are expounding. Let's remember as well that rights innovation at the state level does not inherently favor some rights over others, say blue rights over red rights. It is emphatically neutral. Consider the aftermath of Kelo, the Takings Clause case, which Judge Bork, a believer in restraint, but also an originalist, might have thought failed to account for the original public meaning of the clause. In the first year after the decision, two state Supreme Courts, one from Ohio, one from Oklahoma, rejected the decision in construing their own constitutions, taking clauses. Just as quickly, many state legislatures placed new limits on the eminent domain power. State law developments not only can fill gaps left by US Supreme Court decisions, they also can establish data points for reassessing them. But I do disagree with Justice Brennan in one important respect. This is not a ratchet. State courts may disagree with the U.S. Supreme Court in construing similar state guarantees in both directions, not just one. They may interpret their guarantees to provide more protection or less protection. Otherwise, my approach would not lead to a true free market of constitutional interpretation. In thinking about this, don't make the mistake of assuming that state courts may not go below the federal floor. Metaphors can slay, and that metaphor has done a lot of damage to American constitutional law. There is no floor when it comes to the state courts' interpretation of their constitutions, save for the unusual situation in which the interpretation violates a separate federal guarantee. I can illustrate the point with a well-reasoned concurrence written by Justice Tom Lee on the Utah Supreme Court. In an exclusionary rule case arising under the Utah Constitution, Justice Lee looked at the history of Utah's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures and came to the conclusion that the provision did not come with an exclusionary rule. The state courts are free to interpret their state constitutional guarantees to go above the federal floor, or as Justice Lee pointed out, go below the floor with respect to state law. Here is my last question. Isn't it important to have uniform rights in this country so that when Americans move for one reason or another, they can be assured that the protections they had in one state, they can bring with them to the new state? Yes, I would say in some instances, but no in others. Here I will use the perspectives of Senator Sass of Nebraska, Senator Cotton of Arkansas, Vice President Cheney in his capacity as a congressman from Wyoming, and Ted Olson, a Californian, to aid my argument, not to second guess it. To paraphrase Senator Sass, there is a difference between life in Nebraska and life in Vermont. One group of people is proud of cattle, the other ice cream. How proud they must be. Even sibling states have profound differences. Think Vermont and New Hampshire. Or if you question whether there is really any difference between Michigan and Ohio, just go to next Saturday's football game. No. Not fair. More to the point, no one can deny the remarkable range of cultural, faith, urban-rural differences in this vast country. I want to start with the presumption that we will respect these differences, not the presumption that we will eliminate them. Is it possible that we 21st century Americans have become incorrigible busybodies? Rather than pick on another state, let me pick on my own Ohio. Too often I see Ohioans wanting to tell the people of another state, say Wyoming, how to run their lives. And then my Ohio friends become resentful when the people of Wyoming want to return the favor. Would it not make a little more sense for we Ohioans to take care of things in our own backyard, our local communities, cities, states, whether legislatively or through state court decisions? Then having fixed a problem, why not have the courage of our convictions and let other states adopt our solution if they see fit? So I have no problem if state courts construe provisions, prohibitions on, say, unreasonable searches and seizures or other guarantees to have more or less protection than the federal guarantee. Yes, we should have uniform protections when the U.S. Constitution requires it, but otherwise, let's remember that this is a very big country, and we would do well to mediate more of these difficult disputes locally rather than racing to Washington to enlist Congress or the court to impose a one-size-fits-all interpretation for all 325 million of us. So I've put a lot on the table. Much as I have tried to account for all of your perspectives, I know nagging doubts remain. This is a Federalist Society meeting, after all, and I would be very disappointed in you if that were not the case. But if we cannot agree on all things, I should hope we can agree on one thing. What a wonderful idea once a year to remember Barbara Olson, a quintessential American, in Ted's words, and to remember how she died and how she lived, and to continue generating and debating new ideas in her honor. Thank you.